Hello and welcome back to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Tricarci, and if you can't tell from the intro music, we are all in on the presidential election this year. Obviously, everybody knows that it's only a few weeks away, but what you may not know is that accounting is on the ballot this year. Well, indirectly at least. We think there are two major areas of the financial reporting ecosystem that could be impacted by the election. The first is accounting for income taxes, and the other is the SEC's regulatory agenda. The good news is that we have episodes dedicated to both, so please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss out. On this episode, we are going to take a closer look at the tax policy proposals for both Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris, with a specific focus on the corporate side of the house. We'll explain what the major proposals are from each candidate and then get into how they could impact your financial statements. Then we'll close out by discussing how this all gets done and what happens if we ultimately end up with a split Congress. And I have two very special guests joining me today to help break it all down. First, we have Ashby Corum, who's a partner in charge of our income tax accounting group in our Washington National Tax Practice. Ashby, welcome back to the podcast.
Great, Nick. Glad to be here.
And we also have John Gimigliano joining us for the first time today. John is a principal in charge of our federal tax legislative and regulatory services practice, which basically means he's super plugged into Capitol Hill. Welcome to the podcast, John.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
So, John, I got to ask, Gimigliano, that's Irish, right?
You got it. Exactly. County Cork.
It's not often, to be honest, that I meet someone that's got more vowels in their last name than me, but copious amounts of vowels isn't the only thing that we have in common. John, you host your own podcast called Catching Up on Capitol Hill. Do you want to give a quick plug for our audience who may not be familiar with it?
Sure. We talk about tax legislation and tax policy. So if you're one of the few people that both like podcasts and tax policy, well, please tune in.
Yeah, you do a great job. I mean, it's a very easy listen, even for somebody who doesn't know a whole lot about taxes. And I mentioned today that we're going to be talking about corporate taxes, but if someone wanted to learn more about how they might personally be impacted by the upcoming election, you have some episodes on that, right?
Yep, we do. And we've got many, many more planned for this year because it is going to be a very big year in taxes in 2025.
Awesome. Okay, so make sure you check that out. And with that, let's get into it. You know, obviously, for this one, we are not going to have time to talk about all of the different tax policies for each candidate. But we've picked a couple proposals that we thought, one, people would find interesting, and two, that could create some accounting complexity. And on that note, you know, this is obviously based on what we know today, but admittedly, some of these proposals are pretty high level. And like everything else, the devil will ultimately be in the details of whatever ends up getting passed. But before we get into the specific proposals from each candidate, John, I thought it would be important to just highlight that no matter who wins in November, we are likely looking at some form of major tax reform next year. And I wanted to ask you to just explain why that is.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I spent a lot of my time trying to ask whether or not we're going to have major tax legislation in any given year. This is one of those cases where we know we're going to. And it's because of what you just described, Nick, this tax cliff notion. So if you haven't been following along, when Congress passed the major tax reform law of 2017, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the way they did it, not by choice, but by requirement of the budgetary rules that they used at the time, they had to sunset major portions of the 2017 legislation, basically the entire individual side of the code, along with some important provisions that impact multinationals as well. And those are scheduled to expire December 31st, 2025. About $4 trillion worth of tax cuts will expire. And we are confident we're going to get a tax bill because both candidates, Trump and Harris, have both said that they would extend all or virtually all of those expiring tax cuts. So it seems inevitable. When we get to 2025, Congress is going to be doing a tax bill. We don't know what it will look like. We don't know when it will happen or how they're going to solve the tax cliff problem, but we're fairly confident they're going to try.
And obviously the one big item from the TCJA that was permanent, meaning it's not set to expire under the tax cliff, is the corporate rate of 21%. But I think we're about to find out just how permanent that rate really is. And so with that as our segue, I want to pivot to the election. And John, I want to start with the Democrats. My first question is, how well defined is the tax plan from the Harris administration at this point in time?
Well, I would say, because we're going to talk about Trump, of course, too. And I would say if you were to compare Harris and Trump, you would, I think, objectively say that the Harris plan is more fleshed out, but for a very specific reason, which is she's mostly adopted the Biden era tax plans that have been around in Biden budgets for 4 years, or yeah, our fourth year. So we know more about what Harris is proposing. But even in her case, there are many proposals that she's got that are still relatively vague.
And I guess to follow up on that, is there a headline item from the proposals that we know about at this point?
Well, the biggie is raising the corporate rate from current law 21% to 28%. That is something that Biden has proposed every year of his presidency, and that Harris has picked up and is also proposing. So of all the things on the Democratic side, that is by far the one that is getting the most attention, and is certainly part of the Democratic proposal and platform.
Okay, so despite the fact that I just said the 21% rate was permanent under the TCJA, we could see that go up to 28%, meaning I guess it's not all that permanent if we think about it that way.
Well, nothing is truly permanent when it comes to legislation, is it, Nick?
Yeah, that is fair. And Ashby, you know, obviously tax rate going up, especially by that much, there's going to be an economic impact on companies and higher cash taxes. But what about the accounting implications with a new corporate tax rate? Can you talk about what that might look like?
Yeah, that will bring some complexity to at least account for, particularly that kind of date of enactment pop. Because what happens is when the corporate tax rate changes, a company needs to remeasure its deferred taxes. And that's going to result in a one-time charge to income tax expense. And that could be a benefit, or it could be an expense. And maybe something investors ignore, or maybe they pay attention to. I think a lot of companies are still remember somewhat going through that process with TCJA back in 2017. But there's some complexities around that. Companies may need to estimate the balance of their temporary differences as of the date of enactment. And if that's somewhere in the middle of the year, that may be a little bit tricky to be able to compute. Additionally, if a company has a fiscal year, then they may end up with 1 year with this hybrid rate that's sometimes referred to as a Section 15 rate. That's a little bit of a mix of the old rate and new rate, where they apply it for one year and then move to the new rate after that. And that may require entities to have to go through and schedule out when each of their temporary differences reverse. Similarly, if we happen to get some kind of phased in rate change, which we did not back with TCJA, but if we happen to have one where it ramps up a little bit over time, then that can add some additional similar complexities of having to schedule out when temporary differences reverse.
Yeah, so this is one where, you know, obviously understanding how it ultimately gets enacted is going to be critical to the different scenarios you brought up. But beyond that, also the timing too, right? I don't know a whole lot of companies that are tracking their deferreds, you know, every month. And so if you have to do something mid-year, that's going to be a lot of work from the accounting standpoint. And then to your point, Ashby, anytime we're projecting what's going to happen in the future, when something might reverse, there's a lot of judgment and complexity that comes in with that. All right, let's pivot then, John, to the next major proposal from Harris. What does that one look like?
Yeah, so this is limiting the deductibility of executive comp. Now, unlike the corporate rate proposal we just talked about, where she has talked about it quite a bit, making corporations pay their fair share, it's been very specific about that one. On this one, she hasn't been specific, but nevertheless, her campaign has said she has adopted the revenue-raising provisions of the Biden-era Treasury proposals. Well, this is one of them. So by proxy, anyway, this is part of the Harris plan, and that is limit deductibility of an executive comp to $1 million for all employees of public corporations is the proposal here. So the current proposal is public corporations, but it would be for all employees. You would not be able to deduct comp in excess of $1 million.
Do we think at this point it's likely that compensation would include things like stock comp and deferred comp?
I'm pretty sure that the drafters will be thinking about all the possible ways that taxpayers could get around this rule and anticipate those. And obviously things like, you know, deferred comp, stock-based comp are obvious ways that companies currently do and would adapt their behavior to deal with this. So I would expect that we ought to anticipate having a rule around stock-based comp.
Okay. All right. And Ashby, let me come back to you on the accounting. You know, obviously today we have deferred taxes related to stock compensation and other forms of deferred comp. You know, is there going to be an impact to the accounting for those items based on what John just talked about?
I would expect an impact and the fair amount of complexity. When this first would get enacted, companies would need to remeasure their deferred tax assets for for any impacted form of compensation. So you, as you mentioned, that would likely impact share-based compensation payments, maybe deferred compensation plans, maybe even some bonus or vacation accruals. You could see the deferred taxes remeasured for any of those.
And when you say adjustment, Ashby, you mean a write-off potentially, right?
Right, exactly, a write-off, a lowering of those deferred tax assets. So a one-time expense there.
Yeah, okay. So not to keep belaboring the point, but again, just another example of why the devil is going to be in the details, right? One, how is comp defined? And two, what ultimately is allowed to be deducted? That's going to determine what items on your balance sheet need to be adjusted, if any. So this would be one to pay close attention to. All right. And obviously, there's other tax proposals, you know, that could impact corporate taxpayers from Vice President Harris, including, from what I understand, John, increasing the tax rate on stock buybacks and potentially moving the GILTI calculation to a country by country basis, which, you know, maybe means the U.S. would have an IIR under Pillar 2. I don't know. But, you know, those items aren't expected to create a ton of accounting complexity. So we're not going to go into those in any detail, but I just wanted to throw them out there for the listeners. And with that, let's move to the Republicans. John, you kind of mentioned this earlier when you were comparing the Harris and Trump plans, but you didn't really talk about, you know, whether Trump has a plan, or I guess if I were to use his words, does he have a concept of a plan?
You know, somebody that does this for a living, right, tries to write about the plan. It's challenging because in the case of, you know, candidate Trump, he talks about taxes. He does. But it's less specific. We have less specificity than we did with Harris.
So from what he said, I guess, what's the first item that you think is worth mentioning for our listeners if he were to be elected?
Republicans in Congress have said over and over and over that they are upset about the Pillar 2 negotiations and that they would impose tax rules that would be applied against what Republicans in Congress, in the House specifically, have called discriminatory taxes.
When you say discriminatory tax, just maybe to back up a second, under Pillar 2, is this related to, you know, there's a company that has U.S. income that they haven't paid 15% on, some other country is going to come in and try to collect that difference under either the IIR or UTPR?
It's exactly right. It's really the UTPR that has given Republicans the most angst, that you would theoretically have another country taxing U.S. multinational on its U.S. income through a UTPR, they would view that as discriminatory. Exactly right, Nick.
Got it. Okay. So then this would say, hey, if you're going to do that to us, we're going to come and do that to you. How would something like that work?
So what they would do is that they would impose these taxes on multinationals that are headquartered in jurisdictions that have adopted these discriminatory taxes. So any multinational operating or headquartered in a country that has adopted Pillar 2 could potentially get hit with, for example, these retaliatory taxes. They would impose an additional 5% tax on that company, on their U.S. income, every year until we were up to 20%. So theoretically, that would mean a 41% tax on the income earned by that foreign multinational in the U.S. That's discriminatory tax proposal number one.
You know, Ashby, it sounds like there may be some judgment or uncertainty as to how this would actually work. But if it was how John described it, where we're going to impose a 5% incremental tax, what should companies be thinking about from an accounting perspective?
And strictly how to account for it, it's going to have a lot of parallels and similarities to what we discussed earlier on raising the rate to 28%. You're going to have a one-time remeasurement of deferreds and this one-time adjustment that could be an expense or benefit. You're obviously going to have a higher rate in your financial statements, but also if it's phased in 5% per year, I think maybe earlier you may have heard me talk about a phased in rate. At that initial date of enactment, you may have to look at all your temporary differences and estimate, okay, what's going to reverse next year when maybe it's only a 5% extra rate? What's going to reverse the year after that where it's 10%, the year after that where it's 15%, and anything out years where the new rate's 20% higher than the base rate? And so there may be for that phase in period, there may be a lot of effort to go into the scheduling when temporary differences reverse. And that might add some additional noise in the effective tax rate, not to mention the fact that these companies just flat out be paying more tax and overall have a higher income tax expense.
So there's a theme, I guess, to what we've talked about, you know, remeasuring deferreds, potentially having to schedule out deferreds, and ultimately a net economic impact that seems to be potentially increasing a company's overall income tax expense. I guess, John, let me ask you about the next Trump proposal and whether we're going to keep this theme going.
Yeah, the next Trump proposal, and I guess we should just add real quick, you know, I mentioned that there were two retaliatory measures. We won't get into the minutiae of the other one, but it would basically expand the beat. So foreign headquarter companies could be have a more likely to have a beat liability or a higher beat liability, just as an FYI. But let's talk about the other one. Trump has talked about this a lot. Again, not in great specifics, but it appears what he's saying is we would repeal large components of the Inflation Reduction Act and the tax credits associated with those. As many of the listeners may know, the IRA enacted a number of environmental or green energy kind of tax credits. And Trump has talked about repealing those. Congressional Republicans have talked about repealing those. So almost certainly they would seek to repeal a number of those credits as a way to raise revenue to offset the cost of these $4 trillion of expiring tax items that they want to deal with.
Okay. And John, like from where Ashby and I sit on the accounting side, these IRA tax credits have been basically the hottest thing in tax accounting for the last year. I mean, there's a ton of activity, as you know, with companies generating these, but also now buying and selling them. So to me, this sounds like it could be a pretty big deal for companies that are in those industries. I'm assuming there would have to be some kind of grandfathering allowed here. Like, what would the transition look like if this were to happen?
I think you're right. Right. So Republicans may not like these credits, but what they would like even less is being, you know, charged with having enacted a retroactive tax increase. And so I think we're almost certain to get some transition relief if we did have a repeal of these credits. And they'd put something in place like, you know, where you've got committed capital, contractually committed capital, that sort of thing. You've begun construction on a project. Things like that would provide transition relief where those projects would be able to retain the credits. But it would say that, you know, starting now, the next project will be denied the credits. It's something like that. We're almost certain to get Nick.
So Ashby, I think the economic impact here is pretty obvious, but anything you know, people should be thinking about on the accounting side?
I'm really hopeful and even optimistic that we won't see much on, as far as immediate impact. That all assumes that there's some generous grandfathering of places where companies have already committed capital, where they've built new facilities, built new structures, that they'll be able to still get the credits for those. And so hopefully can, you know, avoid any kind of immediate loss of credits or even impairment of those facilities. So it really may just come through more longer term. You know, that next project they'd plan to do, they, you know, may no longer make economic sense. And so it may be impacted more longer term. Again, all that depends on the, you know, the devil's in the details and assumes that we get some kind of generous grandfathering.
Yeah. And if we don't, obviously, then kind of we're back to our theme of potentially having to adjust some deferreds, right? Which could have some one-time charges coming through.
Exactly. Yeah. And that could be either on the income tax line or potentially on pre-tax if you built a facility that's really only economic if it gets credits.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, I John, I know I said we're only going to do two per candidate, but I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask what might happen to the corporate tax rate under a Trump administration. Do you have any insights on that?
I'm glad you asked about this one. This is one of my favorite topics because, you know, again, Trump has not, he's kind of been all over the place. At one point, it was reported he was talking about a 15% corporate rate. And then at one point, he was proposing or said to a group that, you know, he would love for the corporate rate to be 20%. But more recently, he has talked about a 15% corporate rate on, and I think this is a quote, domestic goods. So we've asked ourselves a lot, well, what does that mean? And our best guess is it some sort of preferential rate on domestic manufacturing. And if you ask, well, why, it sort of makes sense or it aligns with his proposals around tariffs. You know, the idea is that we need to be less dependent on imported goods, but we also don't want to impose an additional price cost on U.S. consumers by imposing just purely tariffs. And if we have a lower rate on the domestic manufacturing of goods, then maybe that all sort of works to create more domestic supply as well as more competitive price on domestic manufactured goods. And so that's one of the things that we're going to be watching for is, does Congress make good on what Trump has been talking about, is this 15% rate on domestic goods?
Got it. Yeah. I mean, I guess from a policy standpoint, it makes sense. But like, how would that actually work? How would you achieve that 15%?
Well, I don't know how you define domestic. And I don't know how you define a good, right? So I don't have a great answer for you, Nick, except that the best I can come up with is, you know, we used to have a code section, and I'm sure Ashby remembers it well, section 199, which was a domestic manufacturing deduction. That section wasn't without its controversies, but we'd had experience over that, or 10 or 15 years of starting to understand what domestic was and what manufacturing was, and maybe we can go back to that for definitional purposes.
John, I want to close this out by talking about, I don't know, a couple of different things. The likelihood of this stuff actually happening, you know, the fact that the presidential election is obviously one thing, but we also have a lot of congressional elections taking place. I actually read something the other day that said every president since 1992 has entered office with their party in control of both the House and the Senate, which I found surprising. But what happens if we end up with a split Congress next year? You know, how does that impact all these policies we've talked about and these candidates' chances of actually getting them implemented?
You know, I look at these presidential proposals as important directionally. They give an indication of where the policy is likely to go. But when Congress gets their hands on these things, they're going to craft them specifically. And if we end up with divided control, you're right, it's anybody's guess, because now we're talking about a negotiation, right? Not only to, you know, trying to negotiate within your own party, you're trying to negotiate across the aisle with the other party. And, you know, as you know, any negotiation is very unpredictable how that's going to go. So we ought to, but we should probably finish where we started, which is failure doesn't really feel like an option. Whereas nobody wants to let those $4 trillion of tax increases take place. So I think we're going to end up with something. It's just kind of hard to predict it right now.
Yeah, it's a really interesting dynamic of something needs to happen, because we can't let this $4 trillion, you know, we can't fall off the $4 trillion cliff. But if we have a divided Congress, you know, what gets through, what gets left on the drafting floor? And again, continuing the theme of the devil's in the details, I imagine a lot of that's going to come through this negotiation process that you talked about. And, you know, we just ultimately have to see what we end up with. So with that, I think I want to thank both of you for joining. You know, this has been great. Hopefully our listeners have learned a lot, not only with respect to what might happen next month, but things to be aware of on the accounting side. So Ashby and John, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And don't go far, because we might need you back in 2025 once we know how the dust has settled. Thank you for listening. As I mentioned, we have another episode coming up on how the election could impact the SEC's regulatory agenda. So please stay tuned for that. And if you want more information about the items we talked about today, make sure you check out our Income Tax Accounting Handbook. It's got a ton of details about how to deal with things like changes in tax laws or changes in tax rates or scheduling deferreds. You can find it on Google or by going to frv.kpmg.us. Thanks again. We'll see you next time.